share with you things about prison ministry and the things that I'm involved in and others are as well. I enjoyed being with Marshall and with Tim, Jim, Chig. We had a seminar on Friday at the Carter County Annex, and it went very well. And just appreciate the work that's going on here, the volunteers, and your commitment to this. I want to share with you a number of things tonight, and I want you to think about when we think about incarceration. The United States has 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's incarcerated population. We lock a lot of people up. You take all Western countries combined in Europe and put them all together, and we still have more behind bars than they do. We have 2.2 million people that are incarcerated in this country. A number I want you to think about is this. In Tennessee, one out of 36 adults is either currently in prison, in jail, or on probation or parole. One out of 36 adults in this state are some part of the criminal justice system. And so we've been thinking about what we can do, and of course our mission is to reunite the returning citizen with God, family, and community, as you saw on the first slide. At the end of the day, 97% of those who are behind bars are going to come out. And they're coming out to your community. They're coming out to our neighborhoods. And the question is, what kind of person's going to come out? The same person that went in? Maybe a person that was worse that went in. Because there's a lot of things in prison that happen that are not a very good influence. Or are we going to go in, like some of you are, and working with those who are behind bars? Now, I was serving as the minister, and this is going to lead into the slide that I'm showing right now, at the Trinity Lane Church of Christ in East Nashville. And I'd been there for 15 years preaching. And so a guy came that placed membership there, and he said, Thomas, he said, have you ever preached a sermon in a prison? And I thought, well, no. He said, well, I go to a prison called Charles Bass, and I preach there, you know, once a month. And he said, will you go with me? I thought, well, I went to Freed Hardeman, got a degree there. I went to Lipscomb, got a degree there. You know, I've been preaching for a long time. I've been asked to go to Charles Bass and preach, and I thought, well, I'll do it once. So I went in to preach there at this prison. There was a chapel that was there. The chapel would seat about 100 men, and every single seat, when we set up the communion and worship, we got it all ready, and the guys come in, and they took up every single seat. They were standing at the back. Now, this prison is now closed, but it was, you know, that was the setting there. And so there was over 100 men in the service. And when I got up to preach, the guys started saying, amen. Well, I got excited with that. Then it was, praise the Lord. I could have jumped a pew at that point. And when I finished my sermon, the guys were all lined up, and they wanted to just thank me for coming out there and preaching. And I thought, I've been preaching at Trinity Lane 15 years. I never get this reaction. They're just out the door when I leave, you know, when I finish my sermon. And so that was really how I got started. But what I began to find out was we'd go in there and preach these sermons, and we'd get people, bring them to Christ, and then they would come out and come to the church and say, I'm out, and we'd say, praise God. Amen. But they had all kinds of problems and struggling. So we wanted to open a reentry center. And this is by the fairgrounds in Nashville, if you're familiar with the area, South Nashville, where they're going to build a brand new professional soccer stadium. I think $200 million or some ridiculous price they're going to pay for this thing. And so here we are, and this is where our reentry center is. This building was the Raines Avenue Church of Christ. It closed in 1985. They gave the building to the Hillsborough Church of Christ in Green Hills. And so Hillsborough wanted the property because being in Green Hills, they didn't have a lot of needs for benevolence. And so they wanted to have this center here in South Nashville, which the area at that time was kind of impoverished, and they wanted to do benevolent work. And the director retired, and the building sat empty. And so we went to the elders at Hillsborough, and we asked for a presentation. And they said, you have 15 minutes, and by the way, we cannot give you this property. So I went in with a presentation about having a reentry center. The presentation lasted 2 hours. The elder stepped out of the room, 5 minutes later came back in and said, we're deeding you the property to the ministry. And so they gave us the property. And we then went in and went into a campaign and completely renovated the entire building, where we can have all kind of programs and things to help people coming out. And that is where our office is centered. And I'll say some things about the programs that we have. But let me talk about in-prison services for a moment. At the end of the day, people that are behind bars are members of our community. I have preached across the state, churches very large, such like Harpeth Hills and Brentwood. I've preached at churches as small as 15 or 20 people. And when I speak, somebody will come up to me after my sermon and say, Thomas, I've got a son, I've got a daughter, I've got a brother, I've got a sister, somebody in my family is in prison. Invariably, wherever I've been, somebody came up to me afterward, and they have a loved one that's behind bars. And so it doesn't just impact a certain population that we often perceive. They are part of our community, and they are there in our jails. We have 95 counties. Every county has a county jail. We have 14 state prisons. They are in the county jails. They then go to the state prisons, but they're part of our community. Now, the number one factor that is resulting in incarceration is drug use. 80 to 85% of those who are behind bars have an addiction to alcohol or drugs. And now, the opioid crisis, there are more people hooked on that than they are on street drugs. And resulting in people dying prematurely and people being in jail. There was an article in the Tennessean, I read it online this morning because I've been here 4 days, that there was a nurse practitioner in Knoxville that was prescribing one patient 51 pills a day. 51 pills. About 30 of them were opioids, and then Xanax and everything else, Ambien. It was 31 times the legal limit of what it would kill most of us. And so here we have these pill mills, and people just, you know, handing this stuff out. And folks are getting addicted to this, and it's resulting in people being behind bars. And so we're trying to help them. They're part of our community. And so what are we offering in our prisons? We have worship services. We have New Life Behavior. Marshall, Tim, and others have been teaching these New Life Behavior classes, such as Christians Against Substance Abuse, Managing My Anger, Parenting. And so we offer those classes. We have pen pals, mentoring, and we're in currently 11 of our 14 state prisons. We have over 500 volunteers, the largest prison ministry of the Churches of Christ in Tennessee. Now, Bible study and prayer. I'm reminded of the story that Jesus told in Luke 15, beginning of verse 11. He told three parables: the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. And the lost son, in this story, he wants his share of the inheritance, and he goes out and he takes it and he wastes it on prodigal living, on wild living. And all of his friends are there to help him spend his money. And it says, when Jesus tells this story, this parable, he says that when he is broke, that nobody gave him anything, and he went to feed the swine, and he wanted to eat what they were eating. And it says, and he came to himself. He came to himself. The light bulb went off. Let me say to you that sometimes God has to break people down completely before they'll listen. Most of those that are in prison and jail have lost every single thing they have. And sometimes even their family, who has separated themselves from them. And so they're at a place in life where when they were out there on the streets using drugs, they wouldn't hear the gospel. But now there is often a receptive heart. And so we're there working with them, trying to help them while they're there. Baptisms. In Sumner County alone, which Sumner County is right next to Davidson County, there in Nashville, where Henderson and Gallatin are, we have over 100 baptisms a year in Sumner County alone. Now, I want you to, you know, see the picture of the guy below. He's covered up in tats. That is very common in prison. A lot of the guys that we see are just, I've got one guy that's in our transitional house that has tattoos on his head. On his head. And he has on his earlobes 13. He was a part of MS-13, Hispanic gang, out of California. And he was living in California. And so they often have a very dark life. They have been in all kinds of situations. Sometimes they've been involved in gang activity. You know, they've gone in here and just, it reflects a life that is dark. That is dark. But here they are coming to the Lord. I had a guy that I was that was in our program, and he had on a short sleeve shirt, and he had a tattoo of a demonic looking creature on his arm. And I tried not to stare. He said, "You're looking at my arm, aren't you?" I said, "Well," and he said, "That's part of my past life." He said, "I'm a Christian now, but," he said, "I still have it on my arm to remind myself of where I came from." So darkness, and it is dark of life in prison. And so it is a place that it's not a vacation. It is a place that in prison, some of these places are violent. Some of these places are very dark. And they are trying to come to a new life. Now, CASA, Christians Against Substance Abuse. If you look there, there's a picture there on the right of a bald man with a green badge on. That's my father. I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. When I was in junior high, my father started drinking alcohol. He became an alcoholic. My father drank every day. My father hid bottles of hard liquor in his pickup truck. My father was diagnosed with a psychiatric illness. He was diagnosed as being bipolar, put on medication for that. He had anxiety attacks, and he would drink. And so my father was fired from jobs. My father was involved in a hit-and-run accident when I was in high school. There was one day, I remember, we came back from Bible study on Wednesday night. My mother always took us to Bible study. My dad never would go. And there was my dad, who was passed out because he had taken a bunch of pills and liquor at the same time trying to kill himself. And I remember putting my dad in the car and driving to the hospital to have his stomach pumped. I wondered a long time, you know, why we had to experience that as kids. And it has impacted us in adulthood. But when I was a senior at Freed Hardeman, my father got sober. My father's been sober ever since. He's in his 70s now. He does have Parkinson's. 3 years ago, I moved my family, my parents, to Tennessee from Texas. My father goes to church every Sunday at the Old Hickory Church of Christ. When my father got here, he said, "Son," he said, "I know you do prison ministry." He said, "I want to go in and teach the class, Christians Against Substance Abuse." He said, "I can't change my past, but what I can do is share what I have with others." And so he taught a class of women with me on addiction recovery. He can't go in now because his Parkinson's had advanced, but he wanted to share his life. And now I know in Romans 8:28, where all things work together for good for those who love God, it helps me to realize now that what happened in my childhood was not good, but God used it for good. And I can now understand folks that are dealing with this right now in ways I could not have before. And so we think about people that are there. Here is NECX, Managing My Anger. We have lots of folks there because of that. Youth Services. See, I'm doing on time. Okay, I'm doing good. The number one predictor of a child growing up and ending up in jail or prison is dropping out of high school. If a child drops out of school, they are more likely to end up in prison than to have a full-time job. That's the number one predictor. They call it the school-to-prison pipeline. The second major predictor of having a child to go up in prison is to have a mom or dad who's behind bars. And so it often becomes generational. Now, we saw a guy Friday in our seminar, and he's an older man. He's probably, I don't know, he's in his late 60s or maybe early 70s. And he said, "Well, my son's at," and he named the prison his son was at. You know, and it's just sad to see families where you see father and son and other family members that are also behind bars. And so we work with the children that have an incarcerated parent. So what do we do with the children? Let's see if this slide's going to change. There it is. We have, one of the things that we do is we have Camp Cope. This is a week-long camp that It's in Castalian Springs, which is the other side of Gallatin, which is not far from Nashville, where we take these kids for an entire week of camp overnight. We're really brave. These are unchurched kids. These are kids that are struggling. We have nurses, we have counselors that are there, and we give them full scholarships to go to camp if their mom or dad's behind bars. And when the kids come to the first day of camp to check in, many of them have a bag of medication to give to the nurse. Adderall, Trazodone, you know, things you just couldn't imagine an 11 or 12-year-old dealing with. I had a girl at camp this past year, and I don't know all their stories, but she was calling my wife, Mama. My wife was in the kitchen, so she said, Mama. She kept calling her Mama. And my daughter was up there, who is at Fried Hardman right now. She was calling her sister. And so this girl, she was over in the craft area. I was over there checking on camp, and she said, hello, Daddy. And I thought for a moment, and I said, you know, you wouldn't want to call me Daddy. I said, you'll miss your mom or dad a lot if you did. And she said, my daddy's dead, my mama's in jail, and nobody else cares about me. I felt pretty bad at that point. To think about these kids growing up in that, and so we work with these kids, and not just at camp, but we work with them throughout the year, trying to help them and to help them to stay out of prison, to help them to be productive in school. We have a Christmas in the prison, we give out, you know, presents. There's a little girl there getting a dollhouse in the visitation gallery of the Sumner County Jail. And so we just collect Christmas presents, collect gifts in December. And then when the kids go in with their guardian to visit their mom or dad, they can get a present. We can help them out. I had a lady that called me from East Tennessee. She was in her 70s. And she said, I've got three grandkids that I've had for 7 years. My daughter is at Tennessee Prison for Women. And she said, I've not had a day's break in 7 years. She said, my husband died a few years ago. And she said, can they go to your camp? And I said, sure. But I said, I can't bring them from East Tennessee to Nashville to spend a week at camp. And she said, if you'll take them, I'll bring them to you. And so she rented a car and she brought them to Nashville. I was really worried at the end of the week whether she'd show back up to pick them back up to take them back home. but she was there, and they had a great time. And these kids, you know, it just brings a smile to your face to see the stuff they're going through in life, and a lot of this is very difficult. And then we are involved in reentry, and that's where I talk about the reentry center, of what we're trying to do to help people who are coming out. We are now, just recently, this summer, we have been licensed by the state of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Department, state of Tennessee, as an outpatient mental health facility. Now, this is not an excuse, this is a reality. When you start talking to people who have been in prison or a jail, and you start asking them to tell their story, there's something that's often in common. Many of them have trauma in their childhood. Physical abuse, sexual abuse, abandonment issues, all of these, and some of these are just horrible, the kind of situations they grew up in. Most of the women that are incarcerated had those kind of issues in their childhood. And so what they have done is they have all this pain, and you don't like the way you feel, and so what you do is you take drugs to numb yourself. You don't have to feel anything. And so, you know, you numb the pain by using drugs, which then causes another set of problems. Had a lady in class, and we were teaching her, and she started crying. She was a young lady. She was in her early 20s. You could say she was attractive, but she had these scars all across her arms. She was a cutter. She started bawling in my class that I was teaching. And she started describing what her childhood was like. And she said, the only relief I get is when I cut myself and I think about the physical pain and it takes my mind off the internal pain. Very sad. Very sad. And so we're trying to help people to deal with this. And so we have We've partnered with Lipscomb University, and we have master level students who are in the marriage and family therapy department under supervision by a licensed marriage and family therapist and a licensed professional counselor, and they provide therapy at no cost to the men and women who are coming out. And believe me, most of them need it. Probably all of us could benefit from therapy, but they really need therapy. And they need it for a long time to work through their problems. And many of the guys, I had a guy that I mentioned that was all tatted up on the head. You know, guys kind of have a thing about going to therapy. You know, they're not really, you know, they're guarded, and they want to keep their feelings in. And it was after the fourth session, the guy that was MS-13, he's seeing a female counselor from Lipscomb. He said, "This therapy thing's kind of working." He said, "I'm starting to feel better." And so he was talking about it, opening up about his life and the things that he had been through. So we're working with them. Workforce development. When people come out of prison, they need a job. If they don't get a job, they go back into what I call default mode, is where they reset and go back to what they know. For women, it's often prostitution. For men, it's often other types of criminal activity, selling drugs, robbery, theft, identity theft, whatever that might be. And so we have to get people quickly in a job. We want them to be productive. And so we help them. I had a guy that was in prison 36 years that came to us recently. He's working at Maynard Select. Just think about how much your world has changed in 36 years. In Tennessee, you can't have access to the internet in prison. Know nothing about email, know nothing about, you know, the internet, know nothing about how to develop a resume. And so we help them with those basic skills, and then we go through a job readiness class that we have each week, and we do, you know, mock interviews. We have a financial management class. Do you know where most folks, I found this out pretty quickly, most people in prison and jail have never had a bank account in their life. You know where they do their banking at? Tennessee Fast Cash, and those places that keep broke people broke. And so that's where they do. And so we try to help them, and so we help them to get a job quickly. So we have partnered with over 300 companies, not just in Middle Tennessee, but across the state, that have agreed to hire our folks, knowing they have felonies, if of course they're qualified, and if they have an opening. And so we go through a one-week intensive course, and we're able to place 87% in a job within 10 days. Now, if we stretch it out past that, we're able to get like 98 or 99% in a job. So we're able to quickly get them in a job. Dawn Stone, she came and spoke to some of the ladies here at Central. She has her MBA. She was working at Dale, very successful. She is a fireball. She's a go-getter. So she goes out and she recruits these companies, like Lee Company, Bill Lee, who's running for governor in Tennessee. You know, they have, you know, HVAC and plumbing and electrical, and they'll send them to school and help them get certified. And so we partner with them, and they're willing to hire our folks. Now, here are some of our graduates that we have, and some of these are some of our recent graduates that we have. There, the guy on the left in the blue shirt, Mr. Kirby, he is from Northeast. And he just came to us about 2 weeks ago. We accepted him into our transitional house. They put him on the bus. We picked him up at the Greyhound station in Nashville at midnight. That's when NECX arrives. Their folks arrive from that prison at midnight. So to be there at midnight, and he's come through, David Kelsey is his name, and he is in our program right now. And he said, "Mr. Snow," he said, "this program is everything that they said it was in the prison." And so we're helping them to move them. Now here's our numbers. In 2016, our recidivism rate, in Tennessee, by the way, the recidivism rate is 46% in 3 years. Now, if you stretch it out more than that, it gets higher. But 3 years is kind of the measuring stick. So 2016, it was 9% with 98% employment. 2017, 4% recidivism rate. And you see the average wage starting out with a felony. $14 an hour. This past year, $15.50. So we're not getting folks, we don't put anybody in a minimum wage job. And by the way, if you've been to Nashville, if you were making minimum wage, you'd be living on the streets. You could not make it there. The cost of living has gone through the roof in that area. The economy is so strong. So we're helping them get into a job and to be productive. I want you to think about the financial impact for just a moment. For the 193 people, I got how much? I have 6 minutes left. I got to move on. $5.4 million has been saved just by keeping 193 people out of prison. Here is Michael. We helped him get his driver's license back. This was 2 weeks ago, smiling from ear to ear. We have AA meetings, celebrate recovery. We planted a church. We have a technology class, a Bible class. And I want to talk about our houses in just a moment. So we have a Sunday worship service. We have that on Sunday evenings. We have a meal. Congregations come and spend time with us, and they worship with us. I don't preach in a suit. I preach from a stool. It's more just of an open discussion because these guys are just, you know, having all kinds of issues. Now, transitional houses, I want to mention this real quickly. So, next door, when we opened the reentry center up, I went out and I knocked doors. And I said, we're going to open up a reentry center in this community. And if you have any issues, here's my business card. I want you to call me. My next door neighbor of the reentry center had this weird look on his face. And I said, sir, what's wrong? And he said, I can't believe you're going to put this reentry center next to my house. And he got a sign of a picture of an assault rifle. He put it on his house, and it said, I have assault rifles, and I'll kill you. And he called one day, and he said, I am an expert on the criminal mind. He said, a person who is a criminal cannot change their thinking. And I said, sir, how are you qualified to be an expert? He said, I watched a movie called A Clockwork Orange. Don't watch it. Don't watch it. And so he had this idea, and so we bought his house. And then he came by one day, and we were leveling it with a bulldozer. He said, you're leveling my house. And I said, yeah, he sold it to us. And so we built this transitional home that we own, a beautiful home, 5,000 square feet, 16 men were approved by the Department of Corrections. And so men are coming from Northeast. I've got two men from Northeast that are in our house right now that are coming to our program, that are a part of the ministry here, that are ending up in Nashville. Here's more pictures of the house. I wish my house had that kitchen. Hardwood floors, marble tops. It's a beautiful home. If you've been in many halfway houses, they're not fit to live in. We drug screen. They have to be sober to stay in our program or they have to leave. Here's a graduation we have. When they graduate, it's a four-month program. They can stay 6 months. They get a certificate. They get to make a cake. They get a $100 gift card. They get to make a speech. And they're very excited, and we help them transition to independence. We're now getting ready to build a women's house, and that's on the opposite side of the reentry center. And the guys asked me, we're going to start breaking ground on this in January or February. They say, what's the difference between the men's house and the women's house you're going to build? And I said, the closet space is larger. And so it is a beautiful home. It's going to be 10,000 square feet, 3,000 square feet of office space. And so we're in a capital campaign. It's going to cost $1.5 million to build this. And we're in a campaign raising money for that. And then I want to close with this slide right here, my last slide. Carlos. Carlos was in the Sumner County Jail in Gallatin. Carlos is from Puerto Rico. Carlos was committing robbery, and he went to jail there. And he was convicted of robbery, and he was sent to the Northeast Prison, NECX Maine, in Mountain City. And Carlos got into a lot of trouble in prison. We asked for their write-ups, and Carlos, he gave them to me Friday. He has write-ups from defiance, write-ups for fighting, and write-ups for kicking an officer in the knee. And so Carlos started going to the classes, the New Life Behavior classes, Managing My Anger, Christians Against Substance Abuse, and guess what? He hasn't had a write-up in the past 2 years. And 2 weeks ago, Carlos was baptized. Marshall was involved in teaching him. Brother Tim was involved in teaching him. There was a hang-up that he had about his baptism. You know, he was told you got to confess sins. He thought he had to remember every sin and confess every individual sin that he had ever committed in his lifetime before he could get baptized. And so Brother Tim, you know, explained that to him. And so he was baptized. And so he gave me his application. He goes up for parole next year. And he said, you know, I want in your house. I want in your program so bad. And he said, but on my ride up, he said, 2 years ago, I kicked an officer in the knee. But he said, I've been baptized, and I'm not the same person. And he said, can I still get in your house? And I said, Carlos, don't get another ride up. You know, and he's really trying to change. And the guy in prison, Marshall said, you know, the guy said, he's different. He's working on himself. He's changing his life. And we're there to help people. And so by helping the ministry, we're helping people like Carlos, who he says he has nowhere to go when he gets out. No family here. Nothing in Puerto Rico for him. And he wants to start his life over. And so this is what this ministry is about. It's about giving people hope. And as we close today, let me just say this. At the end of the day, the problem that folks in prison have in some ways is the same problem that we have, and that's the problem of sin. And the cure is the same. It's Jesus. It's Jesus. And so as we say in the prisons, do you know Jesus? Do you know Christ? Have you been baptized into Christ for the remission of your sins? We say that here. As we encourage them, we also encourage you. If anyone needs to respond, will you do so while we have the invitation song?